Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, 11/20, November 20th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. I'm actually recording this right now in Melbourne, Australia, so I apologize if the sound quality is just a little bit different. I am talking to you from under a blanket in my incredibly loud hotel room. I also don't have access to Patreon right now. For some reason, the website is down. So I apologize that I can't give a shout out to all of my current patrons, but I promise I'll do that again next week. Remember, if you want to support the show, you can visit www.patreon.com/talknerdy. You can also support the show in other ways by visiting my direct website, carasanamaria.com. You can shop in the Talk Nerdy store. You can rate and review on iTunes or Stitcher or any of the other podcatchers that you use. And lastly, just tell your friends about it. I think that's one of the most important ways to spread the word about Talk Nerdy. All right, guys, I'm really excited about today's episode because I get to talk to Maura Aarons Mealy, and she is this amazing woman who wrote a book that really speaks to me personally. Let's see if it speaks to you too. It's called Hiding in the Bathroom, An Introvert's Roadmap to Getting Out There When You'd Rather Stay Home. It does, doesn't it? All right, guys, without any further ado, here she is, Maura Aarons Mealy. Well, Maura, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Kara.
Hi, I'm excited to talk about your new book, Hiding in the Bathroom, An Introvert's Roadmap to Getting Out There When You'd Rather Stay Home. It's a little bit of a departure from my show, which is partially why I'm really excited about it. And it also speaks to me in the most deep way possible.
Tell me.
Yeah, right. So you, like me, you're a podcaster. You have a podcast with Forbes, right?
Well, it used to be with Forbes. It is now no longer with Forbes. That's a whole other story. But yes.
So tell me about your podcast first.
So my podcast is also called Hiding in the Bathroom. And I started it around the same time as I was going to write my book. I decided in the right on Christmas time, 2015, you know, I'm part of this great women's entrepreneur community online, and we were all like making goals, you know, New Year's resolutions. And I said, I want to grow my business and not travel. Like, I want to be able to figure out how to earn more money this year and see people less. And I started listing all the ways that I have done that over the years and that I thought I could continue to do it. And it became this email conversation. And then I wrote back an email with the subject line, "Do you hide in the bathroom at professional conferences?" And it was like, oh, these people just started emailing me in the community. How did you know? I hate them. I'm on beta blockers when I speak. I have social anxiety. Like, the floodgates just opened. And I thought, oh, this is my book.
Wow.
And then a producer for Forbes, it was really kismet, she was part of the community and she saw that email and she was like, oh, this sounds like a podcast. We can talk about being introverted and anxious and having all these feelings at work. So that's how it all started. And ironically, now I want to do a podcast about the patriarchy because I'm so upset about everything that's going on. And I want to highlight people who are like smashing the patriarchy in their own way.
Oh my gosh, that's my new podcast idea. Yeah, you have to do that.
I will do that. That's being worked on as we speak. But I love podcasting because it reminds me of what blogging used to be like way back when I first started blogging. And so it's just a happy medium for me. I don't know about for you.
Oh my gosh. There's so many things about podcasting I love. I love that I can do it on my schedule. I love that you don't really have to have a whole lot of skill to get started and you sort of learn as you go, you know, which is great. And I also really, really love that when you podcast, people listen to the words that come out of your mouth and they don't focus on how you look while you're saying them. So because I work in television, most of my income comes from being in front of the camera. And as a total freaking introvert, it sucks the life out of me. And I'm exhausted by my work and I have all this time where I need to recover after. And podcasting is so great because you know, people comment on the content. They don't comment on like the way your boobs look in your shirt or like the way you had like mascara underneath your eyes because all of your male producers didn't point it out throughout the whole interview. You know? Oh, and so that makes me really, really happy that it's just, especially for me, I do a mostly science show and it's really infuriating when I go on somebody else's like YouTube show and I see all the comments underneath and we're talking about this really intense science story and they're literally talking about my lip ring as if that matters at all.
I have got to tell you, Kara, I feel for female broadcasters like yourself. I did an event with a CNN broadcaster a while back, Brooke Baldwin, and it was actually an event about women's rights and human trafficking and really serious stuff. And then there was an online part of it. And all the comments were like, wow, Brooke, have you been working out? Your legs look really muscular. Or, wow, Brooke, you're so tan. You look amazing. I, on her behalf, I wanted to scream. I don't know how you handle that given what you're talking about. And I never thought about podcasting as a way to separate being judged for your looks from your content. But of course, it totally is.
Oh, it's the best. It's for me such a great outlet. And, you know, not to like hijack the conversation because my listeners have heard this story before. So I'll do the super short version. But I was working on a TV show that was a live daily show with the most sexist, just horrific executive producer I've ever worked with in my life. And he was absolutely gaslighting me. It was kind of in the middle part of my career, but still early enough that I was questioning whether or not I had any talent, whether or not I was, you know, deserved to be in the role that I was in. And just, it was the subject of every therapy session for like a year. And yeah, it was insane. And I went on Joe Rogan's podcast and he really urged me to start a podcast. He was like, Kara, like when you do this, you're your own producer. Nobody is telling you how to dress, what to say. Nobody's in your ear, you know, cutting you off and like fucking with your head. And so I tried it and it was like my lifeline. You know, I do all these other shows and, you know, for the most part, I'm incredibly thrilled. Like I work for National Geographic and I work for Bill Nye on Netflix and it's amazing. And these are really warm, wonderful shows with great crew and staff. But, I still am doing their stories. And when I do my podcast, I get to do my stories.
It's
and I
your
love
story.
That. Yeah.
It's so true.
I love
I feel the
it.
Same way.
And so that must have been a real release for you in writing a book. I mean, that's something I've always wanted to do. One of these days, maybe I'll get around to doing it, but it really is such an intense dedication. You know, it takes a lot of time, a lot of work, but it's all you. Like this book is your deepest, darkest. It's your emotions. It's all the things that you want to talk about and you're letting them out for the world to see. Can you tell me about the process?
I feel like people are sort of embarrassed for me because it's a business book and they're always like, oh, you're so candid. You're so open. I, you know, sort of like, oh dear, should she really have said all that? And I don't care. And I think part of that is also because I have worked for myself for enough years now that I realized I don't care. Like I thought, you know, could anyone fire me if I talked about how nuts I am and all of these crazy things I go through and what it's like to not really want to see people when you run a business. And then I thought, you know, maybe some of my clients could fire me, but I don't think so. And to that, it's like the podcast. It's incredibly freeing. And I would encourage listeners, if you have that voice in you, I mean, like I said, I'm an old school blogger. And when I was at the very first BlogHer conference back in 2005, one of the very earliest mom bloggers stood up and she said, mommy blogging is a radical act. And that is true because the idea that women could take their voice online and talk about the most mundane, like diaper changing and dealing with toddlers and postpartum depression and all the stuff, and that people would read them and take them seriously and then advertisers would pay them, right? And they could build audience. I still think about that every day when I think about podcasting or writing a book. Like the thought of taking your voice and just letting it go is powerful and tough because you might get trolled and there's all this horrible stuff and we live in a patriarchy. But I would encourage people, if they feel like they have something that they have to say, to pick a medium. And some people, it's a book, because a book is a little bit more, it's private, like writing it is solitary. It doesn't become public till you bring it in the world, which is scary.
And you can also kind of wait until you're ready. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas blogging and podcasting, sort of like I mentioned, you don't have to be very good at it at the beginning. And part of that is evolving with your audience. So you kind of put yourself out there and knowing that it's not perfect, you know, like the perfect is the enemy of the good when you're actually working 100%. In this medium. Yeah.
Well, and you should feel, I mean, Andrew Sullivan, who was, you know, he's the political writer and he was an early blogger. And he said, every time I hit publish, I feel a little bit like I want to throw up. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And you still feel that way, because am I going to be judged and people going to think I'm dumb? Am I being crazy? But there is, I have found it very freeing, the podcasting and having a book and just letting it be in the world, warts and all, it's been amazing. I'm not sure I want to do it again, but it's been amazing.
So I want to talk about your actual company, because I think I understand what it is that you do, but I'm not sure it's completely clear to me, because the business world is like a total black box and I really don't understand corporate America. But it's so important, I think, for, you know, people. I bet you a lot of people listening to my podcast are either in academia, they're in science communication, or they are involved in corporate America in some way or another because they have, you know, a normal person job. And so like, and I don't have a normal person job and I never really have. And I don't know, it fascinates me. I also have to admit that one of my best friends, who's like this really strong, amazing woman who has a PhD from Caltech, is moving over into the sort of, what is the world that she's moving into? It's a little bit of like the startup-y VC, but also the sort of management consulting world. And so she tells me all these stories and I'm like listening as she's, you know, discovering this aspect of American economy. And it fascinates me, but also like is so alien. So, okay, you have this amazing company called Women Online. Mm-hmm. And what is Women Online?
Women Online is a social media agency at its heart. I mean, we are not quite an ad or a PR or even a digital agency. We create campaigns that mobilize women for social good. And we do that by creating Facebook campaigns and having Twitter chats and engaging amazing influencers, you know, who are either mom bloggers or YouTubers or who run online communities. You know, we are all about bringing issues that women care about, which let's face it, are pretty much every issue, to the right audience, and then allowing women to use their storytelling and their platforms to get it out there. I actually, as we speak, I'm in Atlanta. I just came from spending time at the CDC, which your audience is probably very familiar with a lot of their health communications folks trying to figure out, you know, for example, antibiotic overuse. Something that, thank God, the CDC is very focused on, but something that we all need to think about day to day. So then my challenge as a strategist is, okay, how do I create online messages, engage social media influencers, create the Facebook Live and the video and the whatever strategy to get that message to consumers? That's where I come in. And it's very rewarding. I mean, I definitely don't have a real job either, because I work from home in my yoga pants most of the time. But
yes,
which is like my dream, and why I left corporate America now, gosh, 11 years ago. But the honor of my work is that I get to come into places like the CDC and help figure really cool things out and then go back to my home office and actually do it.
Oh, that's amazing. It's fascinating. And it's something I feel like a lot of people need help with. You know, I get so overwhelmed, even with my small podcast and some of the work that I do in TV. And now I'm working on my PhD. And so I'm like really spread thin. I actually I have help with my social media. You know, I have somebody that I pay to, basically I pick all the stories, but she does all the hard work of like matching images or GIFs to the stories and like scheduling all the tweets and the Facebooks and things like that. Because it's important to me to provide content through my social media. Like sometimes I use it as a platform to say, hey, I have a new podcast episode. I probably don't do that enough, but more often it's like, hey, look at this cool new thing that happened in science. But it's like a full-time job.
Well, it is. And I think that that's why a lot of people, you know, my girlfriends and I call it blogger disease. Like we get a lot of friends who say, I can't get up and go to work anymore for the man. Like I want to do my own thing. I want to become, you know, like Kara, like you are a true influencer, right? And you work for yourself and you call your own shots. But it is the sheer act of creating the content. It's like feeding a baby bird that never gets enough food. I mean, it is,
it's so
honestly,
true.
Right? And it's like, there's never enough. When people ask me, how do I get more Twitter followers? I say, well, tweet more. I mean, it's a volume game. I mean, obviously you need to be interesting and good, but it is truly a volume game. And that's where it's also coming back to the introvert thing. I have a really hard time with that. I don't have a ton of Twitter followers. Like I'm not one of these people who is sort of out there in social because it makes me feel very naked and it feels like a bit of an invasion of my privacy. So I have to run, I don't know about you, but I have to run my social media on my terms, which is weird because I'm very candid also, but I don't feel comfortable just being out there all the time. And I don't want to engage that much.
I'm kind of the same way. Like it's about, you know, my biggest advice that I tell women who are starting a blog or getting on YouTube or starting a podcast in this kind of science community, is that it's okay to read comments and comments can be really beneficial. You know, cause they really do in some respects hold a mirror up to your work, but you have to read them when you are feeling like you have the mental health status to do so. Like, and it's okay to take a few days off. It's okay to take a few weeks off. If you're not in the right headspace, don't be a masochist. Like just don't read them that day because it's not going to be healthy or beneficial.
No. And then the added layer of being a woman, right? I mean, you can't escape it. It always goes to a place that, you know, it doesn't go to for men necessarily.
Yeah. I'm always amazed by how many, you know, every so often I'll look at my Twitter. I'm much more active on Twitter because it just feels more natural to me. Facebook feels a little bit more, I don't know, artificial. And it's like so much work and I don't really do it on my phone. So really, I only go on Facebook once in a while on my computer. And that's probably why sorry guys, if you've sent me Facebook emails lately, they're piled up. But Twitter, I'm kind of always looking at my Twitter feed because it's also my news feed. And yeah. So I'm engaged with it more. But the other day I went into my settings and I was like, whoa, I've blocked a lot of people. And I don't even remember doing it, but, you know, there must have been a reason.
Oh, my gosh. I heard Lindy West, you know, the amazing feminist writer, explain. She was on Terry Gross on NPR, and she was explaining what her life was like when she was on Twitter. And it sounded so scary and stressful because she's an outspoken feminist. I thought, No, I never could do, I couldn't, my mental health could not take it.
Well, and it's so weird how like, you know, the really base comments actually don't bother me as much when somebody's like, oh, you look like you've been eating too many pizzas. You're like, okay, whatever,
oh,
screw you, right? But it's more like the people who are the thoughtful people. So, you know, as a person who does science work, but I also I'm really heavily involved in the atheist and the skeptic communities. And there's like a weird faction within the atheist and the skeptic communities that's like a harder sort of libertarian faction that is like not, I don't think, profoundly anti-woman, but has these weird tendencies. So what ends up happening is these people who are sort of quote unquote on my team all of a sudden will be offended that I'm being a quote social justice warrior. And they use that as a pejorative. And I'm like, hell yeah, I'm a social justice warrior.
Do they call you a snowflake?
Sometimes I've seen the snowflake thing. SJW a lot. Like that's a very big kind of pejorative that and it's the weirdest thing ever because I'm like, that is so not offensive to me. But what offends me is that we can be so aligned ideologically on all these other things. And then you're like really disappointing me as my fan base, you know, or as a very small percentage of people within my fan base by saying that I should never talk about women's rights issues or minority rights issues because you literally think that we live in like a post-race society and you're so out of touch with reality.
Ugh.
It's a bummer. There are so many people out there that really do think that all of these issues, these feminist issues and these ethnic minority issues, like, aren't relevant or aren't necessary, or that somehow because that all happened in the past and we're well beyond, you know, Jim Crow, or we're well beyond women's suffrage, that somehow these things don't matter anymore. And it's bizarre.
I think a lot of people haven't gotten that memo. And I think the other thing, I mean, you know, like I am very big, and with my own children, if I give them one skill, it is being able to take other people's perspectives, right, into account and have some critical thoughts, not just do everything you think. You know, what's that bumper sticker? The point is that, and social media furthers that, because we live in our own filter bubbles and we are algorithmically trained to see people who think like us. And so I think every once in a while, it's actually really healthy to sort of detox or step back from the fire hose of social media and be quiet in yourself. You know, that is something that, that I have done because that's how I am. But it only occurred to me a few months ago that that's actually one of the ways that I get things done. And that's how I wrote my book. It was because I just had to be quiet and away from all of the literal and figurative noise for a while.
Oh, absolutely.
Of social, especially.
It's so important for your mental health. You know, I co-founded and co-run this retreat once a year called Psycom Camp, which is like a sleepaway camp for grownups who are interested in or actively working in science communication. Many of us are freelancers. Many of us don't get to see each other face to face because we all know each other online. And so it's this really great opportunity for people of various levels to get together in like a kind of rustic camp style environment and just learn from one another. And we have keynotes and workshops and all the wonderful things. And we did a sort of AMA with the founders and with a couple other kind of successful science communicators at our last one. And somebody asked each of us to go down the line and tell them, like, what does success mean to you? And it was a really like jarring question. It's like, oh, geez, you know, like I think we often say like it means making more money, you know, and that's sort of the first place we go. And yes, obviously that's important. But I was sitting there thinking about it. And ultimately, my answer was a little out of step with some of the other answers. And I feel like it was so definitive of me as somebody who has publicly talked a lot about struggles with major depressive disorder. I basically was like, listen, success for me means being able to prioritize my mental health. Because I think the truth of the matter is, when you are in a rat race and you're working so hard that you can't take care of yourself emotionally, psychologically, or you're not making enough money to be able to, because prioritizing your mental health, unfortunately, in America is expensive.
It's expensive. You know,
going to therapy once a week, if that's what you need, being able to keep up with your psychiatric medications, if you're on them, being able to do these like check-ins, like you were saying, taking maybe mini vacations, little retreats for yourself, going to yoga, whatever it means to you, meditating, it's sort of a privileged thing, you know? And it's unfortunate that people who are still just struggling to get food on the table, struggling to feed their children, struggling to make rent, it's very hard for them to be able to prioritize their mental health. And it's unfortunate. I mean, I urge everybody to do it. I think that the core things that you need in your life are like food and water, shelter, and mental health. Mm-hmm. It's fundamental. And I urge you to build it into your budget at that very basic level. But yeah, for me, that is what success is. And I don't think that as a culture, we prioritize it in a way that we should, because we still really stigmatize it.
Not only do we stigmatize it, we actively create systems that hurt people, right?
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's funny. I yesterday on my podcast, I interviewed Ashley Ford, the writer, and you know, she was saying that growing up as someone with mental illness in a really working class Black community, she felt she wasn't allowed to have depression or anxiety.
Oh yeah.
And nor did she have the resources. I grew up in the opposite. I grew up in New York City Jewish culture where everyone lives at their therapist. Like,
yeah.
But the expectation of neuroses almost is undermined too. And I think all that to say that, you know, even still recently, there's been a lot of debate about self-care and it's only snowflakes who need self-care, right? I've actually seen that meme like, oh, all you liberal snowflakes, you need to take care of yourself after the election. That's bullshit. And frankly, if employers in this country were smart, if they had a clue, they would build in ways for us to take care of ourselves a lot better. I mean, many are, right? Whether it's reimbursing your gym membership or allowing people to work from home sometimes so they don't have to commute. I mean, paid family leave would go a long way, better health care.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know,
it's great to see some of them are doing it. But like,
some of them are, but we as a culture are so, I would say, actually toxic to what humans need to take care of ourselves mentally and physically, that it's really a problem. And so much so that if you write about this stuff, people are going to make fun of you. And
it's such a bummer, and we
undermine it.
They give you this like feedback of kind of like, you're just not trying hard enough.
Yep.
This idea of like, you know, that depression or anxiety or any of these mental illnesses are like illnesses of will, as if you can literally will yourself out of them. And I think that we dangerously have this culture of like the power of positive thinking. You know, it's so dangerous, all of these books and all of these like self-help gurus who are basically like, if you just think really positively.
Crush it more. Yeah,
exactly.
And if you just crush it more.
Then you'll get all the money and all the success. And it's like, yeah, so the world, the chips aren't really stacked that way for a lot of people. You know, it's like, come on. It's not a skill game. Like this idea that people literally have that everybody has a level playing field. They're born into the American dream is such a bullshit lie.
It's such a bullshit lie. And you know, the other thing is that, I mean, I love conferences. They're wonderful. And certainly with friends online, they're an amazing way to reconnect. But I think that the conference industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. There are hundreds and hundreds of networking and professional conferences a day. And we're all going to them. And when we go to them, we get those messages, right? We see the keynote speakers. If only we tried harder, if only we networked more, if only we had a personal brand, like if only. And that's not true for structural reasons, for societal reasons, for racial and gender injustice, and also temperamentally, right? As I write about in my book, like I was not cut out to climb the corporate ladder. I have anxiety. I'm a hermit. I'm an introvert. Like I couldn't do it. I could not be on all the time. So I think that in a weird way, like the modern leadership success culture is baking in these messages even more.
Oh, sure. They're totally exacerbating them. I think that's part of why I find so much kind of refuge and solace in our little sleepaway camp that we developed, because it's for science communicators, most of whom are hermits and most mm-hmm. of whom are really introverted. We like bake in. So it's a really small gathering. We, you know, do s'mores around the campfire. It's that kind of a thing. It doesn't feel very like traditional conference center conferencey. And there are just certain things that we do that I think make it really special. Like one of our breakout workshops is called the Freelancer Support Group. And we literally just sit around. It's like therapy, and talk about like our different methods for dealing with writer's block, or for chasing money when we haven't gotten paid, or for knowing how to assess the value of our time, you know, all these things that are really hard for people. It's amazing.
Oh my God. I have a whole chapter in my book about that, about scope.
Yes.
First of all, scoping. Hello. Because every freelancer I know, and I'm not a freelancer anymore, but I feel like one, I run a small business. It rains or it's drought, right? So you could have all this money come in, all these clients, you're so busy, and then they end, and then you're like, oh shit.
Yeah. You're like, I'm never going to work again. It's why it's so hard for me to keep, like, I have an incredible assistant, but I don't need her help all the time.
Right.
You know, cause it ebbs and flows. Like there are times when I'm like, I need help being able to pick up my dry cleaning. I'm so busy. It's going to sit there for a month gathering dust. And then there are other times where I'm like, what business do I have paying somebody to pick up my dry cleaning? That's crazy speech. Like I'm just sitting on my ass all day.
I mean, but you know what, though? Here's the thing. I have learned to love the downtime. I still have bag lady anxiety, so don't get me wrong. I mean, my business is always really slow. January, February, March, like we are always really slow. And there's always a moment around March 28th when I turn to my team and my business partner. I'm like, this is it. We're done.
Yeah.
But what I decided also is to like, try to plan better so that I can enjoy the downtime, right? Like, surely there's a way, and some people, some freelancers are really good at this, where you can get to a point where you can build in the downtime because it restores you. Or like, I wrote my book during a quiet time at work. I decided to put my anxiety away. I had some money stashed away and I'm like, I'm going to take 3 months and do this. So I think that part of what anxiety can do to us also is tell us messages that are not true about how we're never going to eat again. We're never going to get hired again. And I think that part of the challenge is being able to know what's true, know what's not, manage your cash in a real way. Like, let's face it, right? And try to take advantage of the time, because it's a gift that we also have as freelancers to have a little bit of a break every once in a while.
Oh, it's so true. And I think you're so right. Like, anxiety can be this voice that's a little bit kind of dysfunctional and can tell you things that are like a twisted version of reality. And for me, you know, I don't struggle with anxiety as much as I struggle with depression, but I do have a history. Like, in college, I used to have panic disorder for a while, but it passed. But for me, I think what my anxiety does is tell me that I'm lazy. And it's really frustrating because, yeah, right? Like, the times when I do actually think I need to be recuperative, I'm beating myself up for being so lazy that I slept in that day, or being so lazy that I'm just like sitting on the couch with my dog staring out the window when I could be being productive.
Right. You could be getting out there, right? You could be meeting your next big gig or your next big TV show. And again, that's where all the cultural messages come in, because the truth is, and I know this from experience, like having kept my business really small, no one is going to cheer you on if you do less. I mean, this is the other challenge. Like, your accountant and your boyfriend and your whatever are not going to be like, oh, I'm so proud of you. You sat on the couch and took a nap. Like, you know what I mean? And so I think that there's also a piece of it. I mean, I always call myself a reformed overachiever, because I would never have dreamed of not giving 1,000,000,000% all the time. But again, it's amazingly restorative to sometimes do nothing. And it's how smart, brilliant people get their work done. You know, all the data.
Oh, absolutely. I feel very lucky that the woman that I mentioned before, Crystal Dilworth, she's been on the podcast, I think, a couple times now. She is sort of my number one ally in that respect. Like, she always promotes. She actually recently went on one of those podcasts or TV shows, like web series, that's all about like getting her done, you know, like that one of those like total like put, you know, butter in your coffee in the morning and take on the day. And she was like, oh, crap, what am I doing? And she basically had her answers to everything. She was in her mind like, this is not what they want to hear. But like, she had this whole thing about like, sometimes it's good for you to just take a Netflix break. You know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, binge an entire series in a day and never put on work pants. That's okay. And the fact that she is that little voice in my head is really helpful to me. It really, really makes me feel better. Like, if I'm having a day where I just got nothing accomplished and I text her and I'm like, I need noodles, I got nothing done, I'm feeling really shitty about myself, she can really help me understand why I needed that and why it was quite healthy.
I think that's right. And I think if you have depression, I have some days where, and because I work at home, this is hard because I don't have like a forcing function that gets me out of the house always, where I am sad and I can't get out of bed. And I know there are days when I think, okay, it's okay. But there are days when I know it's the depression talking, not me.
Absolutely.
Coming back to the lies. And so I have my pep talkers who, you know, will also say to me, get out of bed, like, get out of your head, you know, just take one step. And this is where actually one phone call, leaving the house to go get a cup of coffee, just doing something very simple can really lift the fog and get you back on track. And I think that that's also a real challenge too, is when do I really need a break versus when is, at least for me, when is my anxiety and my depression and all my feelings keeping me sort of hostage from doing what I need to do?
Absolutely. And that's why I think that networks are so important. Like whether you work from home and you really don't get an opportunity to see people in person and you have a sort of network online, or whether you have a really important group of kind of social support in your community, those kinds of things can be hugely beneficial. Meeting people who are like where you are in your process, meeting people who are a little before where you are or in front of where you are so that you can learn from one another and do it on your terms. All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsors of this week's episode. And I'm lucky to have a new sponsor for Talk Nerdy. It's Morty, M-O-R-T-Y, the newest and smartest way to get a home mortgage. Now, you guys know, I think I've told you a few times that we recently bought a home. And I can tell you that getting a mortgage is time consuming. It can be a bit painful. You actually have to take time off of work usually. And it's stressful. It's like a whole other job. But you know what? Morty makes it fast and easy. They simplify the process and they also help you find the smartest mortgage that's exactly right for you. You just input your information into Morty's secure website. And in less time than it takes to hear this ad, you can shop qualified rates from different lenders. They also want to help you save money because at Morty, there's no commission salespeople. So their experts exist solely to get you the best deal possible. And if you ever get stuck or have questions, someone from Morty's team is always ready to assist you with real-time chat or on the phone. Now, guys, when you can shop loans from different lenders, I don't have to tell you, that means you're able to pick the rate and the terms that best fit your needs. So whether you're a first-time home buyer, you're looking to refi, or you're buying an investment property, I highly recommend you head on over to trymorty.com/nerdy to get started today. That's T-R-Y-M-O-R-T-Y, trymorty.com/nerdy. All right, here's the fine print. Morty Inc. is a licensed mortgage broker, equal housing lender, www.nmlsconsumeraccess.org, number 1429243. Talk Nerdy is also brought to you by Ecosia. Now, guys, I know that I've told you about Ecosia a couple times before, but the reason I keep doing it is because it really speaks to me personally, and I think it speaks to you guys, the Talk Nerdy listeners, because we care so much about science and we care so much about the environment. And of course, Ecosia is a tool that you can use to expand your reach. It's a search engine that uses the ad revenue that your searches generate to plant trees in specific areas that are devastated by deforestation. And the company focuses their efforts in these biodiversity hotspots all over the globe. They've done their research to figure out where growing new trees will have the greatest impact, not just for the environment, but also for the communities that live there. Guys, Ecosia is a tool that you can incorporate super easy into your daily routine, and it adds up to making a really big difference. I highly recommend that you bookmark it right now. Here's what you do. You go to ecosia.co/talknerdy and you'll plant your first tree the very first time you do a search. Just go to this specific URL because that's where we can track the impact that you, the Talk Nerdy community, is making. It's Ecosia, ecosia.co/talknerdy. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Coming back to your book, I am a classical introvert, and people are always surprised when I say that because I'm on stage all the time. Mm-hmm. And I don't struggle with stage fright. I don't struggle at all with being able to get up in front of thousands of people and have a quick chat. That part of it is really easy for me. But the minute that afterward I'm standing there and all these people are coming up to me to talk to me, I am like, just withdrawing into the bushes, you know, like the meme. Like, it's just so hard for me to do. One-on-one, easy. But the minute that I'm in a really social situation where I'm out there, I don't know what to do. I like sit, I'll be at a party and I'm sitting in a chair against a wall, like on my phone.
So what do? You leave? I'm curious. Do you have a system in place?
Yeah. So it's hard because I think sometimes I can't leave because I'm there for an event where I'm either expected to be there or I'm there with the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, my other podcast. And so there's the four of them and we all have to be there. So sometimes I do literally just text on my phone or I'll pick one person and sort of have a conversation with them one-on-one. That is a good comfort zone kind of thing for me. But I'm very gracious. Like I take pictures with anybody and everybody when they come up to talk to me. And if I can engage with them in a real way, everything else falls away and I don't feel so stressed. But when there's like a reception line of people just waiting to talk, it's really hard for me.
I find that really challenging. I mean, I think one of the things that I've found, and it seems to be a good piece of advice in that situation, is I joke that I'm a dog. If I have a job to do, I'm fine. Like, so if I'm in that situation and I have a job, so my job is to connect with two of the people in the room and get their business cards, or my job is, you know, I just spoke. And so, you know what? I'm here. I'm working. This is because I also have social anxiety. So when I start to get into trouble is also I'm tired and I'm drained by all the people, but then I also start to get anxious, like, feeling almost like I'm in middle school and no one will sit with me. Those mm-hmm. kinds of feelings, which mm-hmm. is crazy, I know, but it comes back. I say, you're here to work. This is work. It doesn't matter if people like you. Like, you have half an hour more and then you can go be alone. And then to literally be that strict and try to manage my time and energy. And then also literally to go take a break and hide in the bathroom. I mean, that's where it comes right. from. Literally, there is nothing wrong if you are at an event or in public and you feel like you are Superman and the kryptonite is literally draining that last piece of energy out of you, go splash some water on your face, go take 5 minutes, check your phone. Like, it's okay. People sometimes think you're snobby or you don't want to be there. And that's the thing that's hard when you're an introvert, I think. But
yeah.
People are we're getting better at that. And also, I'm sure if you're in your community, people understand.
Oh, absolutely. You know what we did at this last SciComm camp? And it was my co-founder, Sarah Curtis's idea. And then myself and Jason Goldman, my other co-founder, were like, oh, that's okay. We'll see if it works. I don't know. And then it was like the most genius thing ever is we had this nighttime event. We called it a science carnival. And it was really fun. We had booths set up all the way around this big kind of dance hall. And the booths had fun things you could do, like microscopes. So you could look at bugs, or we had a herpetologist come and bring reptiles you could kind of pet. And we had somebody doing science tarot cards and somebody giving science temporary tattoos. And it was really fun. But we also had a stage with like a talent show. And then we had just music playing in an open bar. And then all these tables where people could hang out. And we knew some people will want to dance, but some people will not be able to get past the social anxiety. They, you know, these kind of party mixer things are really uncomfortable for a lot of people. So we printed a bunch of science coloring book pages and we put them all over the tables and we put crayons out. And it was like the most popular thing is people would be sitting there coloring and they could have a conversation with the people at their table and really connect because they didn't have to have like intense eye contact the whole time.
Yep, and they were able talk.
Exactly. Yep. They were able to talk when it was relevant and otherwise focus on what they were doing. And it really brought together a community in a fascinating way. I feel like in the science community, we're lucky because there's already sort of a stereotype that we're all introverts and like super weird and public. So we can feed into that a little more.
The talent show freaked me out. I can't believe you had a talent show. I know. Talent shows scare me to death.
There were only 5 people who actually performed, but they were amazing.
I'm super impressed. Well, that's the other things. Like I've been flipping networking events on their head. So I've been doing networking events for introverts and there is no milling around time at the front end of the event. I don't know if you all listening, like to me, if I show up at an event and I have to either stand there looking like a doofus or go talk, chat with people or like make my way over to the bar and try to make friends, I can't do that. So what I've done at these events is like none of that up front. You basically, and it's hard because people are late, but try to manage it. And I have greeters. It's like being at a bar mitzvah where you have dance motivators. I'll have greeters and give people a book, give them something to do up front, minimize that upfront time, then have a program and then do a fun activity. And then at the very end, have hangout time. Because by then, like you've all spent time together, you have stuff to talk about, you've sort of bonded. I think that like simple tricks like that can make professional and networking events, which we all have to go to, just a lot more humane and
fun. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Because I feel like the really traditional conferences are the hardest. In the science community, it's the, you know, the professional, like Society for Neuroscience or, you know, whatever your science area is, there's all of these. And you're required to go often as a student or as a professor because you have to present your work. It's really, really important. And those can be the most stressful. But also in like the business world, they have their versions. In the writer's world, they have their versions. Everybody has to go to these really polished traditional conferences.
And they don't think about any of this. 300 a day, remember.
Exactly, 300 a day.
In the U.S.
And half of them don't have harassment policies in place. They don't even think about... We have a big talk at the beginning of SciComm camp that's all about like, guys, like the whole point of this is that it's about like... having a community and finding allies. And if anybody feels excluded, if anybody feels uncomfortable, like we're going to do what we can. And if you want to be excluded and you don't want people to talk to you, like I want everybody to feel the most comfortable they possibly can. So I am here, you know, 24/7. Come up to me if you have an idea. Come up to me if you're having a frustration. Or you can send us an anonymous email by going through this link. And online, we have a harassment policy posted that's got very clear rules. Like I think these kinds of things are important. And it's weird to me that a lot of conferences don't do that.
Mm-mm. Well, I think a lot of conferences are sort of like known to be places where people can be naughty, right? I mean, traditionally.
Yes.
And so, oh, geez, you know.
And there's just, it's all dudes. Like so many conferences are just penis everywhere. Like
they're
just...
penis. Well, and sales. I mean, one of the things that I'm obsessed with is changing how we think about sales, because sales always was certainly like I came up in new media sales, right? It was such a penis fest. It was steak clubs and strip clubs, right? Like that's what you did. You entertained clients. And, oh, right. First of all, even a lot of men don't want to sell that way. You know, selling is about solving someone's problem. It's not about showing them a good time and convincing them that you're like a fun bro to hang out with. Right.
Yeah.
But those stereotypes extending to conferences are still really powerful.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know if it's just because it's low-hanging fruit or we sort of are, you know, socially programmed to just do what we've always done. But it's funny to think that the people who look like they're enjoying it might not even be enjoying it.
Heck no.
That's so funny.
Maybe you know, they'd be rather be watching Netflix. I mean, I don't know.
Probably. Yeah. They're like, I just want to go back to my hotel room and call my wife and kids. Like, you know, like everybody's putting on airs, which is so interesting. You know, I'm looking at the work that you do. And of course, it's called, your business is called Women Online. And you have so much of this like women and work. That's even your website, womenandwork.org. This focus on sort of feminist ideals, sort of, you know, changing the paradigm so that not only are women more included, but women are, you know, I guess empowered in a way that historically we haven't been. And so I wanted to ask you sort of about the work that you do, you know, with some of the digital marketing and things like that. Do you like to specifically focus on helping have a stronger female audience?
I don't know. I mean, I don't only work for sort of classic women's issues organizations. I mean, we do work with Planned Parenthood, for example. I mean, we're very proudly pro-choice and pro-health. But here's the way I look at it. For almost since the beginning of marketing, companies, mostly led by men, and advertisers, also mostly led by men, have made a lot of money off of female consumers, right? Advertisers are obsessed with female purchasing power. And that's why originally online influencers who were women and the mom bloggers in particular, you know, made a lot of advertisers really excited because they thought, oh man, here's all these women who can talk about my new brand of diapers. And I sort of got to a place, and I'm not alone in this, where I got sick of women who use their voices being only seen as marketing vehicles to sell more shit. You know, women vote more. We give more to charity. We don't give as much money to men as to charity as men do because we don't have as much money, but we actually give physically more. We advocate more. We obviously drive health decisions. I mean, women are the key to everything when it comes to change. And yet we're still stuck in this sort of feminine mystique paradigm where we are seen as people who buy things, which of course we buy things and I love my fashion and my, I'm totally, but we're more than that.
That's not all we are.
That's not all we are. And so, you know, there, it seemed to me that there were all these powerful communities and powerful women who were blogging and writing and creating video and creating photo. And yes, talking about their kids and talking about what they had for dinner and what they bought, but who also really cared about everything, frankly, and are now really pissed off and part of the resistance, as we saw in the most recent election, where you had more women than ever, especially new women, and in places like Virginia, running and winning. Like, just because you're a mom, just because you care about fashion, doesn't mean that you're not like a hard-assed advocate. And so that's really the driving force behind my business is, you know, women's voices are powerful. And we're not only about consuming and selling stuff.
Absolutely. I love that. I think that that's so incredibly important. It's something I really struggle with here on the podcast specifically, because when I look at my demographic breakdowns, you know, I do a science podcast and science has historically had a really built-in male audience. And it's really interesting to me, a little frustrating, but also kind of illuminating, because I talk a lot about women's issues. Like, feminism is a big part of my show. It's a big part of who I am, right? So I don't shy away from it, and also really progressive topics. Yet my audience is 80% male.
Wow. But they stick, like, with you. But that's the good news.
They stick with me. I feel like they're feminist men that listen to my show, you know? But it's really interesting to me, because I'm like, you know, I do struggle to be like, why don't more women listen to my show? But at the same time, I am really proud of my male audience, because I think that they are the progressive, very kind of ally type audience that exists and that we need, you know? And so sometimes I feel a little bad when I'm like, oh, it's all dick, because I'm sure they're like, hey.
Hey, I have a dick and I'm nice.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
I'm going to say this, like, I love men and I think men get a bum rap, and I have a wonderful husband. And I have two sons. I think that men are as stuck in these paradigms as we are. You know, I'm obsessed with flexible work and working from home, and having the audacity to say, I need some space to finish this report, and can I please leave this busy open plan office, right? And that gets pinned as a mommy issue, right?
That's true. If a man says that at work, like, he is not going to be received well.
Mm-hmm. Well, but guess what? The majority of remote workers in this country are men, actually.
So
I think that we're all stuck in these toxic paradigms. And I think it's awesome that men listen to your show and stick with, I'm so sorry for all the male bashing. I'm really not male bashing. I'm bashing a system that doesn't work.
Exactly.
And it's not about whether you have a penis or not, I swear.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. It's, you know, it's an interesting thing that I just wanted to kind of, I don't know, bring to light. It's a little frustrating. I think podcasts have a difficult time anyway. Podcasting as a medium, historically, more men listen to podcasts than women. But I do think, or I do see that changing, which I think is really exciting. But we really struggle in the science community, right? Like, there's so many incredible female scientists. And I think the younger cohort is actually more and more female. Like, you see actually more women getting PhDs, more women in sort of the earliest stages, but then it's that leaky pipeline problem where still most of the tenured professors are men. So maybe it's one of those things that's changing. Maybe it's one of those things where we don't have the institutional protections in place for women to be able to thrive. It's very hard to first get a PhD and then do all of the work that you have to do to get a tenured professorship. And it's almost impossible to do if you have children, or if you, you know, have to deal with what we think of these, like, kind of quote, traditionally women's issues. It's changing, but it's changing slowly. So
very slowly. And it's really sad, you know, and, mm-hmm. and all of the talk of diversity and, you know, all the wonderful commercials companies are producing about women in STEM aren't going to change it if the workplace is still toxic and the systems are still rigid. And, you know, and again, flexible work is a huge piece of that.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. Absolutely. You know, I was at a conference, CSICon last 2 weeks ago, maybe, which is the Center for Skeptical Inquiry. It's this amazing organization that was co-founded by Carl Sagan, you know, many decades ago. And it started out as like one of these skeptic debunking, like, oh, somebody claimed they saw a UFO. Let's show how there's like a reasonable explanation. But it's really expanded into a much more like scientific organization. And I was on a panel about problems in science, and we were talking about, you know, the sort of time came in the panel to talk about harassment and all of the difficult things that women deal with in science. And I wanted to open the conversation up and kind of remind people that this is a societal problem, not really a science problem. Like, it rears its ugly head in science, just like it rears its ugly head in production, as we're seeing right now in Hollywood. But it's the fundamental issues really go back to societal issues. And I pointed out, and I felt really bad because I threw them under the bus a little bit, but I tried to say, like, we should use this as a learning experience, and I'm not trying to be shitty to anybody. But there was a costume contest the night before, and the people who won second place were dressed as a pimp and a hoe. Yeah. And I was like, first of all, like, you're celebrating sex trafficking. Like, can we talk about the fact that, like, let's think about what a pimp and a hoe are. And then second of all, the conference actually awarded them, and you know, they said, oh, that's second place, that's a great costume. But then I was like, listen, let's take a step back. Yes, it's everybody who is involved in this process is at fault, and I think we need to use this as a learning experience to understand that this is not okay to glorify, you know, sex trafficking, sex slavery. But also the fact that you can go to a costume shop and buy a pimp costume in a bag or a hoe costume in a bag is kind of the problem, right? Like, it's bigger than us. It's the whole society doesn't understand even why that's bad. And this is the kind of thing I talk about when people call me a snowflake.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they accuse you of having no sense of humor.
I know. And it's like, have you ever met somebody, like you were just saying, you know, did that one-on-one, that panel talking about these serious issues. I've done reporting on that for a local show here in Los Angeles, SoCal Connected, where I interviewed, you know, women who were sex trafficked, and I talked to them about their issues. And once you've been around that culture and that world, which is very much kept hidden from view, you start to realize that maybe throwing those terms around and glorifying it as if it's a choice that these women have when they're brought into the sex trade at 12 years old, you know, it's just like, it's just a whole thing that we've got to keep our minds open, and we've got to use empathy.
Well, we could all use a little more empathy.
Right? Don't you think that underlies so many of these problems?
Yes. Yes.
Oh my gosh. So waking up to the news this morning, and I know this is going to air in a couple of weeks, so it'll be old news by the time it airs, but that Louis C.K., and I think we all kind of knew that it was coming out because we had heard the grumblings of it, but that Louis C.K., there's a big expose in the New York Times that he like whipped his dick out and masturbated in front of a couple of comedians, and that he's like the latest in this long line of these sort of harassers. It actually really depressed me because I really like Louis C.K.
I know.
It was the first one where I was like, it bums me out. Like, it was really the first one. Like, the Harvey Weinstein, it was like, yeah, gross, but like, it was kind of the worst kept secret in Hollywood, right? And then you hear about like Brett Ratner, like, of course. Like, there's all these people where you're like, yeah, of course. But then I'm like, no, not you, Louis, because he's so insightful and he has so much depth, and he's a father of two girls. And I don't know. And of course, I haven't read everything there is to read because it just happened right now and whatever, but it's, I don't know, it made me sad. It's like, not you too. Like, I feel like that's always lately my mentality. No, not you too.
It's horrifying because you think about all the men you know, and you know, some of the men we know by just, they've probably done things like that. And but it doesn't, I mean, this is the hard thing, is that there's still people we like, and I'm sure part of them are still good people. I mean, yeah. I'm not an absolutist like that, you know.
Me neither.
I find it incredibly sad and just very confusing. Yes. Very
confusing.
No,
absolutely. It's like, as a student of clinical psychology, you know, all my background is in neuro and psychology. The first thing I always go to when I hear about like somebody who kills a bunch of people, or just like kills one person, or somebody who is like a rapist, or somebody, I always go to this, like, again, this empathy place where I'm like, what was their motivation? What was their childhood like? You know, how did they find themselves in this place? And that doesn't absolve them at all. I mean, I still think of them as people who like need the justice system to, you know, to do its thing, and also probably need, you know, some amount of kind of mental health care. But that's where I go to. So I'm thinking of Louis C.K. and I'm like, what was the context when this happened? And why did it happen? And how did it happen? And all of these questions just start spinning around in my mind. And it's not because I don't want them to be guilty. I think it's because I can't sit alone. It's very hard for me to just sit with the idea that like shit happens. Like, I'm always like, yeah, but why? But how? Like, I need to understand it. You know what
well,
I mean?
And as a student of psychology, you know that these things are learned over time or some. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think of my babies and then they don't know anything bad like that. It's
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's really, really tough. Well, Maura, I have to say that I've just had the best time chatting with you. I know that you have to leave because we had a quick hard out, but I could honestly talk to you for hours and hours more, and hopefully we'll be able to connect again. What do you say?
I would love that. I admire your work so much. So keep at it.
Gosh, and I yours. Everybody, Hiding in the Bathroom, An Introvert's Roadmap to Getting Out There When You'd Rather Stay Home, is available now anywhere you can buy books. I highly urge you to pick up your copy. And guys who are listening right now, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.